Welcome to this episode of SDI Encounters, a podcast from SDI, the home of spiritual companionship. I'm Matt Whitney. On this podcast, we share stories and conversations around spiritual care, companionship, and contemplative practice across a diverse range of traditions and experiences. Spiritual companions support others on their spiritual journeys through life. Spiritual companions are welcoming and present with those they companion, listening and responding without judgment. And spiritual companions are contemplative and honor silence as a spiritual practice. You can learn more about our work at our website, sdiworld.org. Thank you for listening. Mary DeYoung is a deep ecologist, eco-theologian, urban naturalist, and practitioner and guide of place-based pilgrimage. She specializes in the spiritual companionship of rewilding. Mary facilitates retreats and pilgrimages in the Pacific Northwest and in Iona, Scotland, that strengthen the unique and mystical interconnection of participants, the sacred, and the natural world. How do we facilitate space for the holy to speak through nature, and more specifically, through the bioregion in which we live? How do we meet the growing anxiety that is undeniably present related to the ecocidal destruction of our homescapes and the earth as a whole? Mary came into the SDI offices recently to discuss these things with Frederica Helmier and myself, and she offers a preview of what to expect at the Rewilding Institute that she will facilitate as part of our day before offerings at our 2020 conference in Santa Fe, New Mexico. This is part two of our conversation. If you missed part one, that was released in last week's episode.
And, you know, the nature mandalas that you create, that those of us that follow you on social media get pictures of periodically, are just gorgeous. And they hit me in my soul when I see them, and you explain the pieces that comprised it and where you got it and the manner in which you requested that you
absolutely
might use those
asking
pieces.
Asking them permission.
Yeah.
They've also become for me, and this is what, and I invite a lot of the people with whom I work to do this practice for meditation and ensouled connection, yes, but also a way of practicing what would be called phenomenology. So we're all phenomenologists when we notice and attune to the phenomena of nature. Now, we're in a time where everything is shifting so much, where spring might not feel like spring in your bioregion anymore, or winter might feel really remarkably different than what it felt like 20 years ago. What I found for myself with a monthly practice even of nature mandalas is that it is allowing me to begin to notice deeply who is present in my homescape, mm-hmm. in my own, you know, homeland. And maybe when they've gone missing or when they're no longer there. And in that noticing, there's this attachment that begins to happen. And through that attachment, becomes the seed of advocacy and deep love. So even over the course of the mandalas that I've been making for years, I can look back at a month, you know, like we're in September now, I can look 2 Septembers back, and there are some plants that are no longer. I mean, that's how rapidly things are changing. So it becomes a really beautiful and honoring way to mark time and this time of rapid change.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, Matt, do you have anything you want to ask Mary?
Sure. So Mary, nature, being in nature is kind of having a moment right now, in a fashionable sense. People like going out into the woods and geotagging photos for Instagram, and then people see those and they like going to find those places. And I know just speaking about the Pacific Northwest, it feels like we are loving nature to death in a lot of ways, because so many people are discovering
what it means to be out in the woods, what it means to go climb a mountain and go camping or hiking or boating or whatever. And I wonder if you have thought about that. So I think that there's something deeper there and that you are speaking to in terms of reconnection and communion. But it seems like a lot of what we're doing is using nature. And I wonder if you've thought about how to go from the use of nature to communion with it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that there has been a devastation to our local landscapes because of social media. And I really appreciate and love the kind of more recent kickback to that. There's a hashtag, I think that's find your own spot, I think is what it is, where a lot of these more famous, popular adventurists will no longer geotag where they are because they really want, to honor that location and keep it maybe safe from the throngs of people, but also that there is something in the finding your own way. You've got to be on your own journey. You've got to find that relationship on your own. So I'm happy for that kind of emergence. It's been interesting for waymarkers. A lot of my work actually is in the urban woods, and I will even hold my sessions in an urban forest and do that intentionally so that people can reframe their idea of this wild construct, that it's something that you can go to, that it's somewhere out there that you must journey towards. Working in a more urban location allows the invitation into a perspective that the wild's always here. It's here, and even more so it's within. And so how do we begin to access what we are looking for on that mountaintop or looking for in that deep woods, even in our most urban pocket park, even within? How do we turn that gaze within and begin to access those same topographies, but inside? And that gets a little existential. Like, I get that that could be a hard reach. I think what also this increase in desire speaks to is it's the degree of the separation that has occurred, that we have become so separate from an identity that sees the natural world as a part of ourselves, and even as kin. We have lost so much of an association with those sort of traditional indigenous worldviews that would have that still do see even the orca whale, which is in the Pacific Northwest, very much a species that is in our news cycles as we are seeing this particular species become extinct. Our local tribes know that the whale is kin. The Western mind, which really has influenced the majority of how the global world will think, will no longer see that kin connection. And I think that there is something deep, deep, deep within all of us still who remembers that there is a relationship that we are meant to be in with the natural world. And that technology is just kind of somehow either, I mean, it's doing two things. It's providing a way back, you know, through Instagram, through hashtags or whatever, into that relationship. But it's still also, keeping up this fashionable farce that you can buy your way in through an REI shopping trip and then hopping on a King County bus to a trailhead. But I think it's still revealing something of a desire. There is a lack of that connection. And I think people know that for the sake of the future and this unrest that I think is pretty pervasive, there's a connection between a flourishing future and for one to have a connection with the natural world beyond recreation. But I'm all in if it's for recreation. If you're going out or even in to recreate, right? There's that play, similar play with remembering and remembering. We are being recreated when we remember ourselves as part of the more than human world. But that's going to take some funky work and a little bit of, it's like dating, right? I mean, we begin to date the natural world and it doesn't always go well. You maybe don't say the right thing or you stumble over yourself. But it's a start. And I think I'm all for that start. I'm going to go into deep adaptation stuff, and I don't think we want to go there.
Love it. Next podcast.
Yeah.
I love it,
Mary. Is there enough of a pause for you to edit that out? But I think, yeah, sorry. I just want to keep talking now.
Yeah. Well, we could turn it into two episodes, too.
Yeah.
The positive deep adaptation movement is the movement that is like right on the very next breath of conversation. And that's saying there is no hope for our planet any longer. We're beyond any sort of retrieval of a home planet as we've known it. So how do we live in that reality? And learning how to companion the more than human world together, not just like we are leading, holding the hands of the wild ones to the edge of the cliff that we're all going to jump off of. It really is a mutual, it becomes this mutuality. And I think that that's what people, I really believe people are searching for, that mutuality. They don't have the language for it. It would be absolutely unconscious, but they are looking for a companion to walk with towards these end days. And I think there is hope in that. In that posture of holding hands again, once again with the natural world, in a profoundly relational way. The deep adaptation movement won't move much towards hope, but I really do find hope in that posture of hand holding once again with creation as kin, because I think in that it upsets the entire paradigm that the Western world relies on with just that shift alone. It crumbles the entire great chain of being. It crumbles any hierarchy. And this is also the critique of a lot of the work that I do. With deep ecology, the human really is brought back down into the whole circle of ecology. It's a member of. It is not above in any way. And that would put the plight of the orca right alongside of those who are without shelter in Seattle. And so a critique is that you would serve the more than human world more than you would serve the human. We have such great dire human needs in our age. But you have to hold them side by side, because our human catastrophes that we're seeing globally will not stop, will not end, will not find any resolution until we have come to a place where we can also resolve what we are doing to the more than human world. Every action against the human body is witnessed a billionfold to the earth body. And that is a fundamental kind of theory that's held within the work that I do. So as long as we continue to extract and maim and gouge the earth for minerals that should stay within the earth body, you know, we will continue to gauge and maim and dredge and hurt bodies that are vulnerable who live upon the planet. I mean, they just go hand in hand. And those bodies are most often brown and black skinned women and children. So you will always see, We will perpetuate. We will continue to see all of the horrors at borders, and any sort of marginalized landscape. That conversation that the land, the earth body, and the human body are connected. So I think that as people are trying to find trailheads they're ultimately trying to find their way home, quite honestly.
Support for this podcast comes from the Spiritual Guidance Training Institute. Beginning January 2020, Interfaith and Interspiritual Wisdom Training, a unique online program with an optional urban pilgrimage in Chicago. If you're drawn to companion people of other traditions, including the ever-growing tide of spiritual independence, this program is for you. Ideal for spiritual and secular community leaders, educators, social workers, life coaches, therapists, chaplains, and more. Visit www.spiritualguidancetraining.com to learn more about this innovative offering. And now, here's part two of our conversation.
Yeah, there's so many amazing thinkers who do this work of extracting the realities around like what we are doing to Gaia, right? So this is Gaia hypothesis stuff, that the earth is a living sentient being and everything that we do to this earth body gets mirrored through our own human bodies. Again, based out of this whole idea that we have grown up and out of the earth, we have evolved out of the earth. We are earth evolved. But we're still part of this whole. There's so many things I...
Well, you are. I have many, many thoughts. Thank you for sharing all this. And I want to go deeper on that. One of the things we talk about at SDI and we practice is meditation, contemplative practice. And that through that practice, we shed the illusions of the self, the illusions of the ego, and we are able to attune ourselves to the really real, which is that we are all one body. We're all participating together in the entirety of the universe, what I would call creation. And I would also call God, that we all are sharing in God together. And, I can say that and we can practice that as an idea, but what you are offering is the concrete reality of that. That in companioning with the earth, that we are practicing oneness. We're beginning to practice oneness. Maybe we're not totally there, but we're beginning to. And so I wonder, how would you invite somebody into that practice, into a new way of being in companionship with the more than human, like you described? Is there a simple entry point for people who maybe are hearing this for the first time? Like, what can I do right now?
Yeah, because the earth is so big. And I think even when we talk in, environmental advocacy circles about, I need to save the earth, that can feel, that's more abstract than the universe, right? And this would go then to my encouragement to sink into your bioregion. So your bioregion is different than your delineated counties or city lines or state lines. These are the bioregional features that really define and describe where you live. What are the features of your homeland? In the Pacific Northwest, we have an amazing bioregion that is comprised of mountainscapes, of incredible watersheds, the Salish Sea, verdant valleys. We have the eastern side of the mountains that itself, farms, farmlands. It's beginning to kind of narrow the focus from like universal love and oneness, global earth oneness, to you know, really narrowing down your lens to your bioregion. And I think one of the most profound and simple practices to that end, how do you notice your bioregion, is to look up. Take out ear pods. Begin to listen again to the sounds that are being made by ones who live in your bioregion. It's looking up and taking notice of the topographical features. It's looking for a hill that begins to get bigger to become a foothill that begins to rise to a mountain. And then you might think, well, I don't even know what mountain that is. So then the next step is, that's curiosity, right? So noticing is the precursor to curiosity. So then you get to do the work of finding a map or going to the library. We love our libraries because they are one of the last places that don't require any transaction to be there. It's a transaction-free place, so we should always support those. Third places that don't need money or that require money at least. So you go to the library and you find a map and maybe you look at the name. And then you might find that it has a name that sounds really Eurocentric. So it's like, oh, well, I wonder what the name was for millions and millions and millions of years before. So then no longer are you looking at Mount Rainier, but you're looking at Tahoma. And that begins the process of having a compassionate relationship with your place and its original people. So this has gone beyond simple. But it begins to extract. And then you begin to see how just by a narrowing of your lens down to your, and even your own backyard. So I like to describe that as my homescape. Who lives in my home? Who are the others who are here? That localized lens begins to do the exact thing that we were talking about, you know, universal down to the particular. From the particular, we begin to open back up to the universal. So we begin to open up to all of the wisdom that has resided in our bioregion because of the people who have lived in relationship with the land so well for millennia. And we begin to have greater compassion and empathy and love and advocacy. I mean, it really, I think, becomes the linchpin for it all. I would say notice the seasons. Got to get outside to do that. What does autumn feel like in the place that you live? What does it smell like? What does it taste like? We've forgotten what it tastes like because of our globalized economic system, where you can get oranges no matter where you live, any time of year. Do we know what our local berries taste like? They're really bitter, especially to tongues that have been trained, you know, by corn syrup, right?
Yeah.
So how do we begin to taste locally again? And so that's seasonal awareness. Then, you know, we can begin to turn off our lights at night and be aware of the phases of the moon and the solar solstices and the equinoxes. And why do they matter? Do they still matter if you live in a city? I don't know. I mean, but I think that they do. I think that there is a emotional, spiritual ecology that's connected to what I would call a cosmic ecology. So that which is being arranged and going on up, you know, in the celestial sphere is absolutely speaking to our spiritual and our emotional reality. But there's a mirroring that's even happening up here, up, you know, in the planets and the stars. It's being mirrored down on the earth. So you have a conversation that's even happening here, and we are invited into that conversation and can gain so much wisdom. I think it's putting Siri away and your GPS maps and daring yourself to remember where north is and where south is and where east and west is. And can you feel that in your body? And does it matter when you have GPS and when you have Siri? It absolutely does, because that's going to break down at some point. And can you still find your way? So now we're back to the Hebrew and waymarkers. Can you find the trees and the stones that'll lead you back home? And there's literal ways of thinking about that, and there's, you know, deeply symbolic and metaphorical ways of thinking about that. How do we find our way home? And I would argue that if we've been brought up in traditions that have cosmologies or theologies that would say home is in the heavens, that's probably why we've been searching for home for so long. Because we've lost the reality that home is here. And I think that is why we are seeing such great suffering, ecologically, socially, because of a false narrative or a dysfunctional narrative that was told for too long that we don't belong, that we're pilgrims passing through to find our ultimate home in the sky, in the heavens. It's problematic, it's dysfunctional, and we've got to retell the story. And it's a story of interconnection and interrelationship and even interbeing that we are, because the tree is. And that the sacred that resides in me is the sacred that resides in the tree, in our forests, in the mountains, in the dandelion that's growing in the crack in the sidewalk.
And also in the spider in the homescape that I don't like, that is the abomination that I see and I just want to squish it. But because of this process, that needle has shifted ever so slightly. And I'm like, you have a right to exist and be here.
No.
I can't squish you, but I don't want to know about your process.
I love it. I was hiking up with my girls near Mount Rainier a couple weeks ago, and Juniper came across a little spider, and she had sort of typical reaction of like, aversion, I don't want it. And it sort of came to me in that moment to be like, you know, we are visiting this spider's home. Yeah. This is where the spider lives, and we are visitors here momentarily for the afternoon. And I saw something shift a little bit in that.
Yeah,
I think something I've learned a lot from you, Mary, has been how all of this that you've been talking about can be introduced to young people, to children. Mm-hmm. And I've watched you with your four kids bring them along on this journey. Mm-hmm. We just did our podcast last week on kids and spiritual companioning. And I think about your invitation to a number of local families to join a Kids Moon Club, mm-hmm. a really simple thing. But you get some things, you download some artwork, and you get together ideally every full moon and have a little gathering, a little celebration that reorients kids around what are the rhythms that we celebrate? What counts as a holiday? Mm-hmm. It's not just a time where you consume a whole lot of corn syrup around something that can be relatively arbitrary. But all of a sudden, we find cause for celebration once a month as we note the passage of time. And something I'll always remember that you mentioned early on, we both have daughters, and you're talking about how important it is for our girls to recognize and begin to embody the lunar cycle, so that when they come into their own moon time, when they begin to menstruate, that it is something where they begin to immediately and easily notice that there is a connection there. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for all the ways in which the work that you're doing doesn't just exist among your adult companions and the adult people who participate in your waymarker offerings, mm-hmm. but that kids are a part of this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They know it inherently. So while there might be that little bit of aversion to the spider, their ability to move into that mutual relationship and that inherent understanding of how they're connected to the stars, it's so easy with them. So really, I feel like I learn so much from those opportunities where I get to be with younger ones out in nature, because they show me how easy this relationship shift is, because they haven't shifted that much away from it yet. They still know that the trees talking to them, and that the flowers are the best beds in the world to sleep in. And, you know, they have this intuitive knowing of even what can be eaten. I mean, they're eating dirt because they know that the microbes in dirt are really good for them and their immune system. You know, we teach them away from these things, I think, to their detriment and ultimately to our own. And, yeah, so I think anything that we can do to follow their lead outside will do us a lot of good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This has been an incredibly rich conversation, Mary. Every time I talk to you, I find that there are so many potential paths to wander down, and I'm pleased that we had the opportunity to wander far along one path together today. For folks who are listening to this who want to learn a little bit more about you or about Waymarkers, mm-hmm. where can they go to learn more?
Sure. So you can find me on my website, which is www.waymarkers.net. And I'm also on Facebook and Instagram under Waymarkers as well. So I'd love to connect with you there. And
connect and then disconnect.
And disconnect as well. Absolutely. Disconnect to reconnect. That would be a great place to find me.
And a reminder for folks that Mary is offering an institute before our conference in Santa Fe next year. It is a rewilding institute the day before the conference begins. And you can learn more about that at sdievents.org. Thank you, Mary. Awesome.
Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah. So rich.
Makes me excited to go outside, huh? Yeah.
Go outside. Turn this off.
All right.
That was great.
Anyway. Ah.
Mary is offering a Rewilding Institute for our SDI conference in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in April 2020. Learn more about that at sdievents.org. Hey, this is Matt. I just wanted to say thank you again for listening to our podcast. I hope that you're enjoying it and that you are learning more about spiritual companionship. I hope that you will take the time to subscribe to this podcast through Apple or Spotify or Stitcher, Podbean, however you're listening to this. If you could share it with a friend to get the word out about spiritual companionship and SDI, it helps us with our work. You could even sponsor with us and have an ad on the show. Just contact me at podcast@sdiworld.org and we can make that happen. So thank you so much for being a part of this. To learn more about spiritual companionship and ways that you can plug in and join our community, visit us at our website at www.sdiworld.org. Thank you. Blessings and peace on your day, and may you share blessings and peace to others.